John Markoff has covered technology and science for nearly 40 years, with almost 30 of them at the New York Times. In 1988, he reported on one of the first internet worms. 5 years later, in 1993, he described what he called a map to the buried treasures of the information age. That was Mosaic, the first really popular web browser. And in 2013, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his work on labor and automation. Now in his latest book, Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots, he looks at the developing balance or imbalance between humans and machines. It's published by Echo, and I'm very pleased it has brought John Markoff back to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Common ground between humans and robots suggests a kind of parity or equivalence between the two. Are robots or artificially intelligent machines gaining so rapidly that humans need to seek common ground?
Well, there has been great progress recently. That's what got me back into it, that AI as a field has overpromised and underdelivered for decades. And finally, in the last half decade, some really remarkable stuff has begun happening. But it's happening in perception. Machines can think. Machines can see and they can listen, but they're not thinking yet.
Despite the fact that IBM created a machine that could win.
Can beat human Jeopardy players. Yeah. You know, that's a very complex. It was an impressive feat. But what most people didn't realize is part of that contest was pushing in on the mechanical switch at the right moment. And that machine was really good at pushing in on the switch. And so it had an encyclopedic knowledge, but it also had a mechanical advantage.
I had a friend who worked in broadcasting who said that broadcasters would have an advantage over other people because we're more comfortable in that kind of situation. So we would hit the buzzer at a better time.
Timing is everything.
Your title comes from a poem written in 1967 by Richard Brautigan. He imagined, and I'm quoting, a cybernetic ecology where we're free of our labors and joined back to nature and all watched over by machines of loving grace. Are you as optimistic as he sounds?
You know, I'm more optimistic than most in the sense that I think that it's a human decision. These machines are not a separate species. They're not thinking for themselves. These are products of human designers, and we can design them to be our overlords, or we can design them to be our partners.
Didn't the mathematician Norbert Wiener coin the term cybernetics in 1948?
He did.
What did he have in mind then almost 70 years ago?
Well, cybernetics is the study of communications and control in humans and in animals, and so it's a little bit broader than computing. I mean, Wiener's field encompasses both robotics and computing, and he coined this term, and then 3 years later, he was kind of alarmed, and he wrote this second book called The Human Use of Human Beings because he saw this ability to go in a bad direction.
Several books on automation, robots, and artificial intelligence have warned about their implications for humans. Are we nearing a turning point or even a revolution in automation?
Certainly it's a revolution. We're approaching, for example, speech recognition accuracies that parallel our own ability as humans. Machines are going to be conversing with us. Machines can see, which will, just everywhere from warfare to the workplace, it will transform things. But this notion of superintelligence, this notion of the singularity, I think they're still much more on the science fiction side of the coin than on the science side.
So we should not fear HAL yet.
Well, you might fear the algorithms, but don't think about thinking machines as being separate from humans and sort of on their own.
What reason is there to believe that we are now significantly closer to singularity, as Ray Kurzweil and Verna Vinge call it? Vinge predicted that we would be there by 2025, and Moshe Vardy, a computer scientist, says something like 2045.
That's right. It's kind of a moving target. The notion of the singularity is this vast acceleration in computing power that will somehow, in kind of this Hegelian sense, become intelligent, actually super intelligent. And they pick dates because they look at their curves. And, you know, they see exponentials. This is kind of the Moore's law acceleration of computing power. But in fact, the doors are falling off of Moore's law right now.
And Robert Gordon, an economist, has argued that people forecasting a singularity are wrong.
Well, there's a good reason to sort of be skeptical because, You know, in the late 1990s, there was a real bump in productivity that was related to computer technology. Here we are more than a decade later. Last 5 years, productivity in the United States has almost been flat. How can that be when there's all this technology doing these amazing things?
You emphasize the distinction between artificial intelligence, AI, and intelligence augmentation, or IA. Can you explain the
difference? It's a philosophical difference in approach to computing that I observed in an earlier book that I wrote called What the Dormouse Said, when I saw that at the very dawn of interactive computing, there were two laboratories on either side of Stanford campus that invented the modern computer. One was started by a guy by the name of John McCarthy, and he thought in 1962 that it would take a decade to build a thinking machine, to design a replacement for the human. On the other side of campus, there was this wonderful dreamer by the name of Doug Engelbart, who you probably know because he invented the computer mouse and he invented hypertext that gave us the World Wide Web. And he wanted to use computer technology to accelerate the intellectual capabilities of small groups of intellectual workers. And, you know, the irony is that Engelbart's work directly went to the personal computer and the Internet, and we're using all of his technologies today.
Didn't MIT researcher Marvin Minsky scoff at Engelbart's work?
A lot of people scoffed at Engelbart, and he was sort of cast out at SRI during the 1970s, and it took about a decade for him to be rediscovered. But his technology made its way to Xerox PARC, and then to Apple and Microsoft.
And obviously, as the inventor of the mouse, he was doing something pretty good, unlike what Minsky said. Minsky said he was wasting research dollars.
Yeah, you know, back in the 60s, they thought of AI as being serious computer science, and they thought of Engelbart as doing word processing, and nobody cared about replacing secretaries at that point.
What did he and McCarthy or others imagine might happen with advances in machines?
Well, McCarthy, for his entire career, I mean, John McCarthy coined the term artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. and he went on to try to build those machines, and he had this tremendous impact on the field. And, you know, I never talked to McCarthy about sort of the societal impact. Engelbart really thought the computer technology could transform the world in a positive way, and he made it his life's mission to build these technologies.
Have the two communities, AI and IA, remained separate throughout all these 50 years?
Well, that's basically my point, is those two communities basically talk past each other. That, you know, they've gone in their separate direction. There's the AI community, and we call the other community these days the human-computer interaction community, and they basically sort of see the human as being in the center of the system. And, you know, a good example of the kind of work that comes out of the HCI community is Siri, the Apple assistant that's kind of your partner to help you with day-to-day tasks.
Although she gets things wrong a lot.
She's doing better, but you're right.
She actually, a friend of mine some years back chastised her, and she wrote, she didn't say some words I can't say on the air. And we were shocked when we saw this. I was told that it was actually developed by somebody other than Apple, and that Apple had tried to clean all of that stuff out, but there are always these little glitches.
Well, let me tell you my favorite Siri story. When it was first launched and people were playing with it, people would say things like, you know, Siri, I'm thinking of shooting myself. And Siri would say, you know, I know of two or three gun stores fairly close to you. They fixed that problem.
My guest is John Markoff, whose latest book is Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots. It's published by Echo. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. McCarthy died in 2011. Engelbart died in 2013. Who were some of the leaders in AI or augmentation today?
Well, gosh, that's a huge, rich field. A guy at Microsoft who's done very important work is Eric Horvitz, one of the people who sort of made the shift from systems based on rules to systems based on statistics. A woman doing very important work at Stanford these days is Fei-Fei Li, who runs the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab. Of course, Sebastian Thrun, who started Google X and the Google Car project. It's, you know, we are in the midst of a renaissance of computing technology. There's a range of things happening.
But I suspect you agree with Kevin Kelly, the founding editor of Wired magazine, although he isn't a scientist, when he says people will survive, we'll train our machines to serve us, but what are we going to do for the machines?
Yeah, no, Kevin's a good friend, and we have opposite points of view. I think we have to worry about the people and not so much about the machines.
He doesn't think you don't think we have to – we owe the machines anything?
Kevin is one of these people who think the machines are taking on a life of their own, and, you know, it's just a viewpoint I don't share.
You mentioned that designers resist thinking deeply about the relationship between artificial intelligence and augmentation. What kind of work is being done on that relationship?
Well, my best example in the book is Siri. The two Siri designers, Adam Chire and Tom Gruber, were really students of Engelbart, and they set out to use AI technologies such as speech recognition and natural language understanding to basically help humans.
But are we getting to a place where philosophers are going to get into the act?
Oh, well, philosophers have been in the act for a while. Remember, Herbert Dreyfuss and John Searle at Berkeley were very critical of the early AI claims that machines would think in a human sense.
He developed what's known as the Chinese room argument. What's that?
Well, it's basically the notion that if you could sort of run a set of words into this sort of hidden room and out in Chinese and out would come English, you could say that there was sort of this mind translating them, but in fact it's a blind number shuffler. And, you know, computers can shuffle numbers as fast as human, well, as fast as machine possible, and it's still not the same as human thought.
And sometimes there are all sorts of nuances in language that I'd imagine would get past the computer. The computer might translate literally when we understand that something else is going on.
The machines are getting better.
I think there was a water goat I heard of some years ago. I don't know if you know that story, which was I can't remember, some kind of a ram, but it was translated by the computer as a hydraulic ram became a water goat.
A water goat. Yeah, and you have to remember that years ago, they had a really small set of data, and now computers can basically absorb the entire corpus of human knowledge, and so they're getting better at making those analogies and comparisons.
Some of the technology seem to have been under development for years, like AI itself or self-driving cars. How much of a gap is there between conception and application?
Well, okay, so it's all across the board. I saw last week that 1 billion people used Facebook in a single day. And, you know, Facebook is less than a decade old? So that's really quite striking that it could, because of the internet, it could reach the entire globe. On the other hand, the mouse, which was invented in 64, didn't become really mainstream until 1989, 25 years later. I have a friend in Silicon Valley Paul Saffo, who likes to say, never mistake a clear view for a short distance. I think is something to remember.
Well, laptops eliminated the mouse. There are ways of getting around it.
That's true.
But it's the same concept, isn't it?
There are different ways of selecting things and moving them on the screen. And the mouse was a very efficient one. Trackpads in the laptop sense are very good. And, you know, there are others as well.
In talking about the gap between concept and development, Google has really come up with self-driving cars, but I have no sense that they're ready for widespread commercial use.
Well, yes and no. So Google has done spectacularly well in their program. They've driven more than 1 million miles without a computer-caused accident. However, something happened in April which was very significant. They changed the nature of their program. They went to this new program called Chauffeur, which is this tiny little car without a steering wheel, without an accelerator, without a brake. And it's designed to basically take you someplace at low speed, 25 miles an hour, in an urban area or on a campus. That, you know, sort of unstructured goal of sort of replacing the human and standard driving, they ran into a problem when they began to let their employees take the cars home. You know, before they had professional drivers sitting watching over the machines. And they found when their employees took the cars home at the end of the day, and they were distracted, they would do things that were distracted driving up to and including falling asleep. which is a huge problem when you have this situation where at some point the computer is going to hand off control to the human. If the human's asleep, it just doesn't work.
And then the New York Times reported today that a Google car stopped, as it should, to let a pedestrian go by. It was hit from behind by a human-driven car, which wasn't expecting it to stop and follow the rules. And they also described a car that just couldn't make a left turn because all of it has to wait until the other cars have stopped totally, and human drivers tend to inch up.
Forward, and it confuses.
So it just sat there for a long time.
These are called edge cases, and solving those edge cases is one of the limits on completely self-driving cars. And I actually think that maybe if we thought about this from a design point of view of designing cars that won't crash rather than self-driving cars, it might be actually more useful.
I'm just wondering where Geico fits into all of this.
Geico's going to make money either way, I'm sure.
We're also going to see a lot of people lose their jobs if we have self-driving cars.
Well, potentially, although I think that completely self-driving cars, you know, what year is it going to be when there are going to be commercial trucks on the freeways without humans in them? I'm willing to bet that it's not going to be for a long, long time.
The Times article made the point that humans and machines are an imperfect mix. And Dmitry Dolkov of Google said that humans need to be, in his words, less idiotic.
Good luck on that. Well, we're more and more distracted all the time, right, as we are surrounded by gadgets. So we actually need the machines to keep an eye on us.
My guest is John Markoff, who has been a technology and science reporter for the New York Times since 1988. His latest book is Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground, published by Echo. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with John Markoff of the New York Times. His latest book is Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots. It is published by Echo. Aren't there already devices in some cars that augment our driving? For example, the ones that correct our mistakes, the ones that self-park?
There's everything from self-parking to adaptive cruise control, blindside protection, pedestrian detection, bicycle detection, auto stop. It's starting to technology is starting to wrap around the driver.
With what's now called the Internet of Things, could drivers and bicyclists and pedestrians all be networked so that they don't have the problems that we see so often?
I hope so. There's an interesting experiment going on in Minneapolis right now with a technology called V2X, which is a sensor network that would do exactly what you want.
Would it keep the bicyclists in the bike lane? Or tell them, move over.
Well, as a bicyclist, I think bicyclists should have some rights too, but that's a debatable issue, I guess.
You were talking about something in Minneapolis. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so there is a sensor network called V2X that's being developed globally. And basically, if you're coming to a blind intersection and both cars have sensors, they'll be aware of both the cars and potentially if pedestrians and bicyclists have these sensors too, cars will be able to know of their existence.
It would be nice to feel safer crossing streets in New York, but doesn't that also raise many privacy issues?
Well, privacy and security issues. I mean, there are some absolutely terrifying scenarios if every car has a sensor and the sensors can be hacked. There certainly are privacy issues if cars can be used as sensors. I'm sure if there's some bad thing that can happen in theory, it can probably happen in practice.
Well, we saw this situation with the Jeep that was hacked and the control was taken over from the driver.
Yeah. Yeah, there can be terrible scenarios. I don't know if we should stay away from the technology because of the worst possible thing that we can dream up.
Well, is part of the problem that it's almost impossible to create a hack-free computer system?
This is why I gave up the computer security beat. There was a moment that I realized it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. It was time to do something different.
Have you watched Mr. Robot?
You know, I've watched a couple. Kind of fun, kind of correct. I was kind of impressed. But I haven't binged watched the whole thing
yet.
But
it does suggest that anybody can be hacked.
You know, it is very, it's, you know, it's an uneven race. It's very, very difficult to build a secure, completely secure system.
I wondered about just simple things like Social Security. When the numbers were introduced, they were supposed to be for government use only. Now businesses and many other institutions ask for them as a matter of course. If we have various networked semi-intelligence devices, are we going to be supplying still more information to governments and businesses?
Well, you know, total information awareness and the stuff that Edward Snowden showed us suggests that the government has the ability to watch the population with a giant digital vacuum cleaner, and that's clearly still going on.
And many people considered him a traitor. Do you think that he did a service?
I see Snowden as a whistleblower. You know, I think that civil liberties are one of the things that differentiate America from the rest of the world, and we probably should protect them at all costs. But, you know, that's just me. I'm a journalist.
Self-driving cars may not be available, but what are some of the leading examples of robots that are already in place that we now kind of take for granted?
Well, you know, the automotive manufacturing industry was one of the first to really broadly adopt robots. So you have everything from robots that assemble cars to the most common physical robot in the world is the Roomba. I mean, I think they've sold more than 1 million Roombas, and they're out there. You know, this is the robotic vacuum cleaner. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of intelligence, but it does a pretty good job of getting the whole floor in your house.
Auto factories are heavily automated. Where else are people at risk of being replaced by machines?
Well, you know, I think the most interesting sort of form of automation of the last half decade that's had a sort of underreported and big impact is what's happened to white-collar workers in American corporations since 2008. And this is called, you know, business process engineering. And so companies like PeopleSoft and SAP and Oracle and IBM have basically given companies tools to replace the clerk class inside the corporation.
And we're talking to a machine when we call a customer service. Sometimes you can't even tell if it's a computer until it doesn't respond to your question. And it can be very frustrating.
It can be frustrating, but I actually think that technology is going to evolve very quickly. The IBM Watson technology is moving that direction. The machines will become better conversationalists. And if the machine does a better job of talking to you than the tech support worker, will you care whether it's a machine or a human being?
You mentioned ag robots. Are robots in agriculture replacing or augmenting humans?
Well, first of all, you know, on the scale of things, there are almost no humans left in agriculture. Remember, we've gone from a situation where more than half of us worked in agriculture just as recently as the turn of the last century to a point where there are only 2% of our workforce is agricultural.
I read that when people in low-paying jobs demand a certain amount of money, that's when agriculture and other places suddenly turn to robots.
Yeah, that's right at the heart of the debate in the fast food industry. The argument is if you raise the minimum wage, it's going to push these corporations to replace workers with technology. And, you know, I think it is going on in any case. I mean, the cost of the technology is falling so quickly that those jobs were already at risk.
So it's it's more cost effective now than it might have been 10 years ago.
Very much so. And then you run into the question. I mean, President Obama ran into this interesting sort of controversy in 2011 when he sort of made the assertion that there were fewer human tellers as a result of ATMs. And it turns out, because of the nature of branch banking and the falling cost of computing and telecommunications, that there are branch banks everywhere there are Starbucks. And the banking industry wanted to have humans facing the customers. And so they've stayed flat. Where he made his mistake is it's basically like a neutron bomb went off in the back rooms of banks, that there was an entire class of people who moved paper who are just gone. And so there has been a huge impact because of technology. It's just that there are still humans facing the customer.
And there are many people who still want to hand that check that they're depositing to a human rather than putting it into a machine.
Have you tried taking a picture of your check with your smartphone and doing it that way?
I have not.
Well,
but I'm sure that it works very well.
It does actually work.
Are there some kinds of work that are immune to replacement?
So this is the big debate. So there is a group of computer scientists who argue there's going to be this vast machine intelligence. And I'm more on the side of MIT economist David Otter, who basically says there's a class of complex tasks and flexible jobs that involve multiple components that are not easily replaced. And so we'll have big impacts in certain areas, but it won't be everywhere, and it won't come as quickly as people think.
Well, some people have suggested that a job like mine can't be replaced by robots, but then I have seen some interviews where the questions were so robotic, I wondered whether they couldn't have just had a machine ask the questions.
Are you familiar with the company Narrative Science, the company
No.
that's writing stories for news organizations like Forbes and Associated Press, computer-generated stories, financial stories, sports stories, stuff that I did as a cub reporter is being done by machine now.
So the information is just fed into the machine, and it writes the story in perfectly good
Yep.
English?
Yeah. It's not they're over the lowest bar. As early as 1984, I visited an AI research center in Los Angeles, and the demo involved taking the AP wire and writing editorials based on the wire stories, and you picked right wing or left wing by turning a knob to the right or the left.
Wow.
So this is not
so you can put a left slant or a right slant into the story?
That's right.
My guess is John Markoff. Do we do that with you, John? His latest book is Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots, published by Echo. Amazon has raised the possibility of using drones to deliver packages, and Charlie Rose got all excited about that on 60 Minutes a couple of years ago. Would those be autonomous, or would they be remotely piloted like U.S. military drones?
No, I think the vision is that they're autonomous, that the warehouse would be very close to certain residences, and you could turn these drones loose. I know that NASA is working on sort of air traffic control systems for drones, which envision a sky that's black with, dark with mechanical devices. And I don't know if that's what we want in our world. We're going to have to decide as a society if we want drones among us.
Or the sky's darkened by drones.
Yeah.
Is Amazon also aiming to automate its warehouses because it's bought Kiva systems?
Well, they have used Kiva. Kiva has been deployed already in many warehouses, both Amazon's and others. And Kiva's interesting because they took the problem and they broke it down into constituent parts. And the part of the process of what's called piece picking that machines can't do is they can't pick up things, dexterous manipulation, and they can't recognize objects. And so while they waited for that to happen, and it will happen fairly quickly, they decided to leave the human workers in one place and move the objects to them. And that's what Kiva does.
Given the reports of poor working conditions and dissatisfaction among warehouse workers at Amazon and elsewhere, might those machines not be welcome?
Well, the joke that I've heard told is they finally got air conditioning in the warehouses because the robots needed air conditioning to work.
Military drones are remotely piloted, as I mentioned, and a group of industry leaders and researchers, including Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking, recently signed a letter arguing against fully autonomous drones. Is the United States or any other country working for artificially intelligent weapon systems?
Completely autonomous systems already exist. The U.S. is in the process of deploying what's called a semi-autonomous weapon system, a cruise missile that is it's called semi-autonomous because the human makes the targeting decision, but then the robot flies to the target and it matches it with the human decision. That's called semi-autonomous, as opposed to actually hunting for the target all by themselves.
One of the people you discuss in your book, Jerry Kaplan, was recently a guest on our show to talk about his book, Humans Need Not Apply. He also had an essay in the New York Times making a case for AI weapon systems. Did you see that?
I did. We've actually debated it as well. I'm on the other side of the coin.
Is Silicon Valley still the heart of innovation in artificial intelligence or augmentation?
Clearly so. I mean, they're in the United States, I mean, I can look all over the country now to see interesting AI research and actually commercialization, but I think the center of gravity is still the Valley, with perhaps, if you're talking about robotics, Boston, a close second.
New York City has touted a Silicon Alley. Are we far behind?
Well, it's Silicon alley in the sense that the internet is Main Street and New York is Main Street for the world. And so, there's important technology here. For example, Jan LeCun at NYU is a Facebook artificial intelligence scientist now, and he's here in New York.
The fastest supercomputer is in China. Is China competing with the U.S. in artificial intelligence or augmentation as well?
Yeah, the Chinese are investing very heavily to catch up all along the stack in terms of information technology from software down to chips. And, they're still trailing, but there's important stuff going on in China.
Have countries made commitments as to developing automation as opposed to artificial intelligence?
Well, I think that automation technology is being deployed all over the place. The question is, what kind of an impact will it have? And in China, for example, I thought that it might be automation technology that was a force for social disruption. And I was talking to Danny Kahneman, the economist, and he said, you don't get it. In China, the robots are going to come just in time. And his point was that China's an aging society. And because it's aging, at a certain point, its workforce, like in Japan, is going to start to shrink. And the Chinese, it turns out, may need robots.
And India will become the most populous country in the world.
That's right.
Then go through the same cycle?
Well, I assume so. I mean, it turns out as the GDP rises in different countries around the world, the demographics change.
You quote a Dutch engineer, Binne Visser, who says machines can be designed to manufacture any consumer device in the world. Are there any numbers on the percentage of manufacturing now done by machine or how many people still work actually making stuff by hand?
Well, I don't have the specific numbers, but I can tell you that as machines become less expensive and more dexterous, that they're doing more and more in manufacturing, and you can see that all over the world.
Unemployment is around 7% in the Netherlands, where Visa works, but it has a larger social safety net than the United States. Will we have to restructure U.S. social programs to respond to AI or augmentation?
I think depending on the rate at which it's introduced in the society and, restructure social programs. One of the things that I thought of is that maybe if we invested in education to give people the ability to retrain themselves quickly, that might have as much social impact as anything. And that's what Sebastian Thrun did. He was the one who founded Google X and the Google Car project, and he's gone off to develop that kind of an AI-based training approach to allow people to go back and get what I guess he thinks of as nano or micro degrees to make them more equipped for a dynamic economy.
In a 1966 science fiction novel called Colossus, two supercomputers start communicating and take control of the world to protect us from ourselves. Does anybody think humans will be better off if AIs eventually take over, especially ones that are programmed to do good?
Well, maybe you're talking about being watched over by machines of loving grace. That's a science fiction world that I think about. I actually think more about Star Trek and the Borg. Resistance is futile. You will be assimilated. And I worry about a world in which we all take directions, everything from what Korean food to buy to who we should marry from the smartphones that are in the palm of our hands. I mean, so maybe it's already happening.
John Markoff will be in conversation with Stephen Levy tonight at 7:30 at the Greenlight Bookstore. That's at 666 Fulton Street in Brooklyn. His book, Machines of Loving Grace, The Quest for Common Ground Between Humans and Robots, is published by Echo. And John, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on our show.
Thank you for having me.